This is The Doctor Is In, your bi-weekly podcast that discusses all things technical and not so technical. The Doctor Is In podcast is produced by ARRL, the National Association for Amateur Radio, and sponsored by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST editor Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the doctor himself, Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
I want to talk about an antenna that I've known about for a long time, but I always thought was really odd, frankly. Huh. And just the shape of it, how it works, and that's the log periodic. And you see these things with some frequency, no pun intended.
Yeah.
But
tell many us, frequencies.
Tell us the magic, Joel. How do these weird antennas work?
Okay, well, a log periodic, or actually the more proper name for it, is a log periodic dipole array, or LPDA, is a multi-element directional antenna that has a much wider bandwidth than many other types of directional antennas, and that's really its claim to fame. It consists of driven elements. They're all driven, and they taper from the rear to the front. It's fed from the front, actually, but the elements go from the rear to the front.
Yeah, being fed in the front, I thought, was particularly odd. Yeah. It was one of the first things that struck me when I first saw one.
Well, that's the way they work. And they're driven by a common parallel transmission line. As other antennas with parallel connected elements, the power tends to go to the elements that can take the energy well from the transmission line, so they're, you know, fairly close to resonant antenna elements, or multiples thereof. And what effectively happens is a group of elements close to the resonant frequency of the applied signal that comes to the antenna is what's actually used. The rest of them don't really play any part in it. They just are there. Much like if you have a 20, 15, and 10-meter parallel dipole and you feed it on 15 meters, there's very little energy that goes into the 10 and 20-meter elements, even though they're connected. They tend to go in the one that's close to resonance.
Oh, like the legendary fan dipole.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
So imagine a LPDA designed to operate from 14 to 30 megahertz, which is a fairly common arrangement. This will likely have the largest element in the rear, typically about as long as a 20-meter Yagi's reflector, 14 megahertz being beginning of 20 meters. The front element will likely be about the size of a 10-meter Yagi director. So they taper in between, and the angle of the taper and the length of the boom between them is one of the design choices you can make as you apply the various design formulas. Essentially, the longer the boom length and the more elements, the more gain you have, as you might expect, and also the smoother the impedance variation as you change frequencies. But they can be fairly short. The first time that hams had an introduction to this that I'm aware of was when antenna designer L.B. Siebeck, fortunately no longer with us, W4RNL, published design formulae in the 21st edition of the ARRL antenna book. But the type of antenna was actually invented in the late 50s, and it became a big hit, and its first big application was as a TV antenna.
Oh, yeah, right.
Because before that, if you ever looked at antennas, in fact, I don't know, not only looked at them, I used to install them at one point in the 50s, I guess, they had to cover a very wide range of frequencies. Each TV channel has a bandwidth assigned of 6 megahertz. So the VHF channels were actually in two groups, one from 54, right above 6 meters, to 88 megahertz, which was channels 2 through 6, and 88 megahertz was where the FM broadcast band started. And you had a big gap, and people had just clicked the channel selector, had no idea what was happening here. They went from channel 6 to channel 7, but they're going from 88 megahertz to 174 megahertz in that one click.
Yeah.
Channels 7 through 13 were 174 to 216 megahertz. I mention that not because there's going to be a quiz on this, but just to give you an idea of the bandwidth that this antenna had to cover. So you hook this up to a television set, it's got to receive signals from 54 to 216 megahertz. And before the log periodic, there was no really good way to do that effectively. I mean, people did it, but it could have worked a lot better. And,
yes.
And people had all kinds of arrangements with stubs and one thing and another to try to make it work. The log periodic allowed an antenna to be designed to cover from 54 to 88, and then by folding the elements in to make them kind of a V-shape towards the source of the signal, the third harmonic would actually line up and be pointed in the same direction.
That's so genius.
It was a very clever design, very straightforward. And all of a sudden, that was the kind of TV antenna that people used. And it just covered, basically it covered the VHF channels. And what would happen is for your UHF, which was not real popular early on, didn't work all that well. Technology wasn't quite up to it for low-cost broadcast receivers. But the UHF was typically added on in front. There'd be kind of a separate UHF log periodic in front of the VHF log periodic. You'd see kind of two kinds of things. So it worked out very well, and that was a big application for it. But it went other places, too. And the military often has needs to cover multiple frequencies. They used log periodics covering sort of the range 14 to 30 megahertz, and sometimes they'd be stacked with the common feed point, and the stacks would not be parallel. They'd be pointed together so that the higher frequency ones were closer together. You'd see them all over the place in military bases.
Off the New Jersey Turnpike, there used to be, it might still be there, a monstrous log periodic antenna. The thing was huge, and it's part of a military installation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they're all over the place. I remember when I was in the Army in Frankfurt in 63, 4, 5 kind of time frame, the consulate building that was there had a bunch of log periodics on the top. They actually used those to monitor broadcasts from the Soviet Union and its friends in the Eastern Europe. There were, I don't know, two or three of these guys, and they could cover the whole range. And they had a room full of 51 J4 receivers, which I got to see one time. There must have been 30 of them. And they monitored all foreign broadcasts, and a bunch of people sat there and translated them, and they could receive any frequency over that range, and the 51 J4 could do the same. And they actually sent that stuff out by teletype every morning. And when I was operating at the microwave station and making sure everything was working, we could plug in a teletype and we could get the news from Eastern Europe. And it went from there. It went up through our network, up to England, and then to the U.S., and ended up on the president's desk, we were told.
When I look at a log periodic antenna, it always looks to me, and I know the difference, but it always looks to me like a Yagi. I'm expecting to see a reflector element in the back and a director and the driven element and so on.
But it sort of functions in that way in a way. I mean, it's not parasitically coupled. It's a driven array.
Well, I was going to ask, if it's directional, how does it achieve that?
Just because of the phasing of the signals in the different elements. Same way with a parasitic array. That's how it works. It receives energy, and the length of the element determine the phase shift, and it re-radiates, and it adds up in the direction you want it and subtracts in the other direction. This does the same. And in fact, there's actually a combination. You occasionally see a Yagi that has a 3 or 4 element cell of log periodic antennas as a driven element to extend the bandwidth, not real far, but just a little bit to cover a wide band, like a single amateur band. You know, a typical 3-element or 4-element Yagi is a little tough time covering all of 20 meters well.
Yes.
You usually have to choose which end of the band you're more interested in. But you can expand the bandwidth by having a wide band log periodic cell in the middle, and then have a parasitic reflector and a number of parasitic directors in front of it, so you get the combination of the two.
Okay. Now, I have seen a couple of log periodic antennas, commercial models for amateur radio applications, although they were VHF, UHF. How come we don't see an amateur radio log periodic being sold for HF?
Oh, you do. There are a number of them around.
The
major manufacturers of amateur antennas, many of them also offer HF log periodics. The problem with log periodics, and it's not a problem, it's just the design trade-off, because the antenna only uses a portion of it. Let's say you have a 14 to 30 megahertz log periodic. Well, at the 14 megahertz end, you're probably using half of the boom length of the antenna. The rest of it isn't doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were making a 20-meter antenna, you could have one twice as big in the same space.
Okay.
So maybe you're not willing to give that up. Similarly, even more dramatically, on the other end, on 10 meters, you're using maybe a fifth of the boom. So you look at that and you say, well, wait a minute, I can make a 20, 15, and 10-meter antenna, for example, that's shorter and has higher gain and fits in the same space. What you're giving up, of course, is the, well, nowadays, 17 and 12 meters.
Right.
But also, you no longer have the capability to listen to shortwave broadcasts very well in between spaces or some other kinds of signals you might want to listen to. So it's a trade-off. You know, you get a continuous bandwidth and you get less gain than you would with a dedicated Yagi for each band, and less gain than you would from a trap Yagi for a couple bands.
Now, if you had to advise an amateur radio operator who wanted to make a decision whether to install a Yagi antenna, we'll say for HF, versus a log periodic, what considerations, I mean a financial, a shopping decision, if you will, that he would have to make.
Well, you'd have to say, do you need all that bandwidth, you know, or do you just really want to operate on the ham bands? Because it's easier to design an antenna that works on small segments than the whole range of frequencies. The amateur band only antenna can be more efficient in terms of space and weight, number of elements, and probably cost, and provide additional gain and so forth. So, you know, it really doesn't buy you a lot unless you want to cover all the frequencies in between. If you're interested in shortwave listening or monitoring certain services or whatever, it can be very useful. But it's a hard sell, to my way of thinking. It's a hard sell for a ham antenna to want to do that just because there's so many other antennas that can fit in less space and provide more gain. And I've seen HF antennas, HF log periodics in the $1,000 to $2,000 range, which is kind of comparable to multi-element. Yeah, and you can argue, well, the log periodic doesn't have any lossy traps. Well, traps aren't all that lossy, and they have loss, but the design of the antenna makes up for that with additional gain. So
that's true.
Yeah.
Well, that would explain then why you really, at least in ham applications, don't see that many log periodics in use.
I think so.
It's a consideration of the cost and the size versus the frequencies you really feel you need to cover.
Right.
That makes sense. Well, Joel, I have a question, as usual, but let's hear from DX Engineering, and we shall return.
Okay.
Every ham radio operator knows speed matters. Whether it's jumping in your truck during an emergency or staying up all night for lightning-quick contesting, seconds count. And there's nothing more painful than being off the air waiting for equipment to arrive. At DX Engineering, we know a thing or two about speed. You can count on us to provide the fastest shipping in the ham universe. How fast? You get same-day shipping on most orders placed by 10 p.m. Eastern Time. It's that fast. So that new rig, antenna, cable assembly, or replacement part you need will make it to your shack in plenty of time to work a remote DXCC entity or dominate the competition in the next contest. And the best part is DX Engineering offers free shipping for most orders over $99. Radio waves travel at the speed of light. Lucky for you, so does DX Engineering. Visit DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back, Joel, and I have my question.
All right.
As promised. Dean N06J, almost said N0J, he's asking, my transceiver's high SWR alarm comes on when I transmit using my 1kW amplifier. I'm hoping it's a submarine klaxon horn. Anyway, I recently wrapped the DC power cable going to the transceiver. Then I coiled up my amplifier's AC line and the AC line going to the station's 13.8-volt power supply. So far, everything seems to be working okay now. I have no change in SWR when operating high power. So do you think everything is okay now?
It could be, but the evidence suggests that the problem was you had RFI getting from your linear when you're running high power into your radio. So it wasn't really causing a change in the SWR. What was happening was RF was getting into your SWR monitoring circuitry and giving you that alarm, which didn't really belong there. By the way, that RFI was also there when you were running 100 watts. It just wasn't enough to cause the alarm to go off, I suspect.
Ah.
So your coiled cables raised the common mode impedance of those lines to keep energy from getting coupled in on those lines into your transceiver, and that's probably how the energy was getting in there. And by the way, you didn't talk about what bands you did that on. It is likely that the amount of coupled energy is different on each band. So the fact that it's fixed on one band may not mean that it's fixed on all bands. You may want to check that and make sure, find out what you're doing. Maybe you didn't have a problem on other bands, but nonetheless, it's going to be different on each band, probably. Now, I would suggest, you know, you do have RFI going on there. Now, even if you're keeping it out of your transceiver, it's in your station somehow. It's either in your station because it's coupling from something in your station, perhaps a coax cable that has common mode current on the outside of the shield, or some other source. And that RF energy is not going out your antenna and going where you want it to. So you might want to spend some time trying to eliminate that just on general principles, even though it might not be causing an alarm. Sometimes it's not common mode, but actually you get enough pickup on your cabling in the station directly coupled from the antenna.
Oh, yeah.
Which,
true.
You know, if the antenna is right above the station, that can easily happen. And, of course, it'll be more if it's 1,000 watts than 100 watts. And you can deal with that with various kinds of shielding. And perhaps that's not as big a problem because it's not, it's just there. It's part of the environment you live in. But in any event, I would make sure you know what's happening and try to get rid of all the RF you can from inside your station that's not supposed to be there.
Yeah, I mean, regardless of whether it's setting off an alarm, it's a good idea to suppress all of it.
Yes. Yeah, because anything that's there, is not where you want it.
That's right.
And it's not also, it's also, you know, it was coupling into your transceiver. Well, it's also coupling into your power lines and could reset the clock radio or the fire alarm or whatever.
What about his neighbors? Could that potentially cause a problem there?
Well, if it's common mode current, it's conducted from his antenna. So that would probably be just for him.
Just his house. Okay.
And similarly for the direct coupled from the transmitting antenna. Depending on the distances involved, if you live in a neighborhood with houses close together, it's quite possible the distance from your transmitting antenna to your neighbor's equipment of various sorts is comparable to the distance to yours, and you'll have similar levels in both places, so you could have a problem. But if you have some distance between your house and your neighbor's, or your antenna and your neighbor's houses, chances are you won't have much of a problem there.
So it's really confined to his environment, his SWR alarm, and so on. But you're right. It's getting it down to the point where the SWR alarm isn't being tripped is a great thing. But it really makes sense to put in the extra effort to really try to reduce it.
Get rid of it.
Absolutely. Okay. Thank you, Joel.
My pleasure.
If you have a question for the doctor, email us at doctor@arrl.org. The Doctor Is In podcast is sponsored by DX Engineering at www.dxengineering.com. Background music provided by Purple Planet at www.purple-planet.com. This podcast is copyright ARRL. All rights are reserved. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.